The first case on calendar this morning is Hohenstein v. Nevada Employment Security, case number 58519. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, you may do so. You filed a reply brief, so you can reserve time for rebuttal if you'd like.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I do intend to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. She'll let you know when the rebuttal clock comes on.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Karen Teisling. I represent the appellant in this matter, Clinton Hohenstein. Mr. Darren Lemieux is co-counsel with me on this case. He is not present today in court. He has, since taking on this case with me, moved on to Colorado, and it has been agreed by him, Lewis and Rocha, the law firm he's with, as well as our client, that I'll be taking the lead and representing solely here today, if that is acceptable to the court. This is an appeal from an order of the district court denying Mr. Hohenstein's petition for judicial review of the determination of the Employment Security Division Board of Review denying Mr. Hohenstein's unemployment benefits. This case arises from an erroneous decision of the USD to deny Hohenstein's unemployment benefits for his alleged misconduct with regard to his work as a teacher for the Washoe County School District. I want to be clear that this appeal does not dispute his termination in any way. This is limited to the issue of whether or not the denial of his unemployment benefits was appropriate and lawful pursuant to the statute. It's a separate and distinct analysis than whether or not the school district had grounds to terminate Mr. Hohenstein. The district's court's denial of the petition for judicial review was error for two reasons. The first reason was it was an error of law for the district court to rely on the appellate board's finding that Mr. Hohenstein's misconduct had anything to do with his entry of a guilty plea or a conviction pursuant to Mr. Hohenstein's involvement in the diversion program. As the court is aware, NRS 453-3363 provides for a diversion program for first-time drug offenders who do not have a prior criminal history and have not been engaged in violent crime. The black letter law of the diversion program and NRS 453-3363 is that in adjudication, that there is no adjudication of guilt. If you enter a plea pursuant to the statute, you go through a rigorous treatment program, and the reward for that or the benefit of that program is that you are then not considered convicted for the purposes of employment and a number of other issues.
And in fact, isn't that the key here, that there is a plea of guilt or an acknowledgement of responsibility that may have been driven solely by the desire to get the diversion program, and therefore with no conviction and no meaningful way to assess why he entered that plea, really the basis upon which they denied this unemployment is not present. Is that a fair statement?
I believe that is a fair statement, yes. That is our position, is that it should never have been considered in the first place. His guilty plea, his arrest, his subsequent procedure through the diversion program, it was completely inappropriate to be considered, and it was error for the appellate referee to even take evidence on the issue, which he did. He took significant evidence on the issue, and the record is clear throughout the record that he referred to it as a conviction, that they considered the guilty plea, that there was a complete misunderstanding by the referee of the meaning of the program and what the program was really designed to do, which is restore these people to a fresh start, for lack of a better word. It's to give them an opportunity to go forward, having received the treatment they needed, and not be stigmatized by having entered the program at all.
But what about, there are other prongs in the referee's decision. I mean, I agree with you on the conviction prong because the statutory language is so clear.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the conduct itself and what that amounted to for the school district could be considered. And that's a little bit trickier analysis to my mind. You said a moment ago none of those facts could even be considered, but I think that might overstate it a bit, depending on what the facts were. If you had somebody who had done something or was accused of doing something of serious threat to children, for example, you know, sexual misconduct with kids or something like that, they could consider the charges whether or not they had yet been proven, correct?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the distinction that you make is a very, very important one in terms of the crimes or conduct that could potentially put children at risk. It is undisputed that there are certain things that we don't want teachers to be doing that would, in fact, endanger children, and that we do trust teachers with our children. The distinction in this case is that Mr. Hohenstein, even if you look back to his actual conduct, which was possessing marijuana plants,
At home.
There's no allegation that he ever had them on school grounds. There was no allegation that he was ever under the influence at school. The conduct at issue is his possession of the plants, which goes to the heart of the issue, which is that he had a good faith belief that he was not in violation of a school policy.
Is this because of the fact that he thought he had a valid medical marijuana card?
Yes. Correct. Or he believed he was in the process of obtaining a valid medical marijuana.
Which would have allowed him to have the plants that he had, arguably.
That is correct. And he
in his mind.
In his mind. Correct. And that goes to the heart of it. So that really negates any sort of intent of wrongdoing and any, which is a key
willful
to the misconduct.
The word is willful, isn't it? The word is willful.
It has to be willful and deliberate, right, correct. A willful and deliberate violation of a known school district policy.
And that raises another question. Did they even set forth a policy to be violated?
Well, that's very unclear from the record as well. And our position is that it was error, that the employer did not meet their burden in showing that there was a known policy that Mr. Hohenstein violated. The record shows that the one clear, undisputed policy that was presented was the drug-free campus, drug-free environment policy, which speaks to conduct on school grounds or Washoe County School District grounds. It doesn't speak to off-duty conduct at all. They also stated there were two other policies. One was articulated as a K-9 teacher could not be convicted of a felony. We've addressed that with regard to the fact that the diversion program guilty plea doesn't count as a felony.
Which goes back to the policy issue.
It goes back to the policy issue, correct. They also have articulated or attempted to articulate a very broad policy of, well, any violation of the litany of conduct that's set forth in 391, which is the grounds for revocations of teachers, is also sort of an unwritten policy that all as teachers are expected to abide by.
Is there a willful aspect to that policy to violate it?
There is a willful aspect to...
Or a requirement, I guess, is a better word than aspect.
Yes. Our position is that there is a willfulness requirement that is clearly articulated in the case law that interprets how we are to look at the legal definition of misconduct. It's clear that there must be an element of wrongfulness to whichever policy you decide to accept, that there must be an element of wrongfulness. And again, Mr. Hohenstein just simply doesn't have that element of wrongfulness, and there is evidence in the record, albeit in his defense, and that goes to his credibility, but there is significant evidence in the record that he did have an honest belief that he was acting within the law and would not be punished in the way that he was.
What about the argument that, and I think they try to make findings on this basis, that there was immorality associated with this conduct?
Yes, the immorality argument is interesting. I think we all can accept that the immorality is the legislature's word, not necessarily anybody else's. But the immorality aspect of it is clearly defined under the statute as a certain list of crimes that are conduct that constitutes crimes that can be committed. The interesting thing is 453-336, which is the crime that Mr. Hohenstein was accused of, it encompasses 453-336, which, as the court knows, encompasses also the diversion program, as well as the medical marijuana affirmative defenses by reference. So the fact that if there's an immorality aspect to it doesn't really address the issue at all, because it just takes us right back to the analysis, the first analysis, which is simply that he did try to obtain the benefits of the diversion program. He completed the program successfully, the record reflects, and he had the good faith belief that he was acting within the law by possessing it for a known medical condition that he had a prescription for. Does that address your question on immorality? Okay. With that, I'd like to reserve my remaining time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You have 4 minutes and 19 seconds.
Counsel, as you approach, I'd like to offer a question that may be obvious from some of my other questions, and it's quite simple. I'm not certain that I see, and I'm not trying to second guess what the district court or the administrative level did, I'm not quite sure that I see substantial evidence showing either intentional conduct, and I'm absolutely certain that I don't see a conviction, which would be required. And so I am, I'm pretty concerned about the standard upon which this rests, and I hope that you will address that.
I will attempt to, Your Honor. My name is J. Thomas Susich. I represent the administrator of the Nevada Employment Security Division. Your Honor, it's the position of the Employment Security Division that the argument that's been made by the appellant in this, the appellant in this case, is in fact a mischaracterization of the nature of what occurred in this case. I'd first point to the court to its own decision in Barnum versus Williams. In Barnum versus Williams and in the subsequent case of Bundley, Clark County School District versus Bundley, this court clearly held that the standard of misconduct was not a criminal standard, but a civil standard or an industrial standard. So we're not here determining whether or not Mr. Hohenstein was ever convicted of anything. That is not relevant, as the referee held in this decision.
That turns right to the policy question, whether or not there was an adequate policy in place.
Well, that's the second thing I wanted to point out in both Barnum and in Bundley. In Barnum, this court clearly describes what is the standard. Pardon me, may I get my water?
Sure.
What is the standard that one must look at to determine whether or not misconduct exists? And if you look at the Barnum decision, this court held that the misconduct is the violation of a standard of conduct which the employer had the right to expect. In the Bundley decision, this court held that that standard could be put forth through a written policy, but it by no means ever held, and I don't believe there's any case that this court ever handed down that says there has to be a written policy for everything that might amount to misconduct in the workplace. The employer does not have to anticipate every possible thing that could happen that might be considered misconduct.
In the workplace.
In the workplace, or connected with the work.
And so if you had hypothetically an individual who was lawfully growing marijuana plants in their home pursuant to or in accordance with the medical, the license, that would not be considered a problem for the school district?
Probably not, but your question contains numerous, with all due respect, statements that are not consistent with the record in this case.
That's why I said hypothetical.
Yes. Hypothetically, you're right. But in this case, the testimony that was presented at the administrative hearing by the claimant himself was that he did not have a registration card, that under Nevada law there was a requirement that he did have a registration card, but he was in the process of getting the registration card.
Was that possible at the time this event occurred?
Is it possible? Why?
Was he able to get a registration card at the time this event occurred and obtain a license to grow marijuana in Nevada? Because the referee's decision refers to him not having a license to grow marijuana in, what was this, 2009.
Right.
But could he have gotten a license?
Well, it's not clear, at least to me. He did have a recommendation from a doctor of osteopathy in California that said he could benefit from the use of marijuana for the purposes of a neck injury that was causing him headaches and pain in his back.
Which would make him eligible for a license in California.
True. Possibly. To me, it's not clear, but I'm assuming there is law.
And with all due respect, you are a man of great learning in the law, and you've practiced law for a number of years. It's not clear to you. That's of concern to me when you lay that gloss on the willful misconduct that's required by the statute for discipline.
I agree that maybe Mr. Hohenstein was confused about whether or not it was possible. I'll grant him that. But there are other factors in this case that he simply doesn't meet. First of all, he doesn't have the card, which is a requirement which he knew he had to do. It's like having a driver's license to drive or a license to practice law.
But you have to have the card. Could he have gotten a card in Nevada at that time? You don't know.
Could have. I'll concede that he could have gotten it if he would have followed the proper procedures to get it. But he was not permitted by law to use marijuana for the purpose of addressing his illness until he had the card.
Where would he have gotten the card?
From the state of Nevada, through the registry process that was available to him to obtain it.
So if he had had a California card but no Nevada card, that would be your argument still, that he needed a Nevada card.
He clearly needed a Nevada card under Nevada law, and furthermore, there was no evidence that he had a California card. What he had was a recommendation from a doctor. The other thing that he didn't have, or that he never established, or that the record reflects, is that he had more than 1 ounce of marijuana, which was more than the amount of marijuana that was allowed or permitted by a person having a card in Nevada to use it for medical purposes. And there is a specific finding in the referee's decision that he had more than an ounce of marijuana. He was asked numerous times, did you have more than an ounce? And his response was, well, I'm not sure. It depends on what you mean by more than an ounce. And then he was asked again, well, what do you mean by that? Well, I'm not sure it was all usable. He went through this colloquy with the referee, avoiding the question.
What proof was presented that he had more than an ounce?
His admission to the district court. When he entered his plea, he was specifically asked by the court, did you have more than an ounce of marijuana? And he said yes.
But that was for purposes of the plea, was it not?
Well, of course.
And furthermore, Counsel, you raised a really good point. You said, same would be true if someone didn't have a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
Under school district rules, or at the administrative level, someone doesn't have a driver's license and they drive to and from school every day, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Same treatment for that person?
If he's driving without a valid driver's license and it's a requirement of the law of the school district that any teacher have a driver's license, then yes, that's misconduct. That gets into the issue that we were talking about when we started, is how is this a violation of the school's policies? This is a matter of law. Under NRS 612.391, a teacher may be dismissed as a matter of law for immorality. Under NRS 391.3...
Is that a little ambiguous in this situation?
Pardon me?
Isn't that a little ambiguous in this particular situation?
Not at all. Because
why?
If you look at NRS 391.311, it specifically defines what immorality is.
But we're not talking about his dismissal, are we?
Yes.
We're talking about his denial of unemployment.
That's true. But what the referee is required to determine is whether or not the school district had a reasonable expectation that the claimant, Mr. Hohenstein, would comply with these rules. That's what misconduct is under the definition of this court. So can a district, such as the Washoe County School District, look at the law and say, it is specifically prohibited as a matter of law for a person to commit an act forbidden by NRS 453.336. Is it reasonable that they could expect that of their school teachers? And the answer to that has to be yes, because it's a matter of law.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you raise an interesting point under 391.311.4a, which is what you're talking about. It has an exception. It says an act, immorality means an act forbidden by, and then it cites a bunch of statutes, including the one you just referenced, inclusive, except an act forbidden by, and then it continues on. Does that capture 453.336.3 sub 4, which is the...
I'm not familiar with subsection 4 off the top of my head. Is that the one that talks about that under certain circumstances you can use marijuana or more than an ounce of marijuana?
Well, I guess it's the diversion statute, and I don't know where it falls in the listing in 311.4a, which says, what I'm interested in paragraph 4 says, discharge and dismissal under this section is without adjudication of guilt and is not a conviction for purposes of employment. How does that statute fall into 4A of 391.311? Do you follow the question?
I think so.
Okay.
I would submit that the statute which is in play here is 391.311,
right,
as you pointed out. And 391.311 or 12 says you can dismiss a teacher for violation of 391.311, which is the definitions of immorality. The definition of immorality is not that the person must be convicted, but that he must engage in an act which is forbidden by that statute. So there is no requirement for a conviction, and therefore the issue that's set forth in 453.336.3 isn't present. And as you also pointed out, we're not here to talking about whether or not he should have been fired. We're here talking about whether he meets the criteria for misconduct under Nevada law for the receipt of unemployment insurance benefits.
Well, but you're saying if he should have been fired, he should be denied.
Now, we give benefits to people who are fired all the time. What we look at under NRS 612.500 requires a separate and distinct analysis, considering all evidence and all of the record, to determine the conduct that occurred. We do not deny benefits because people are fired. We look to see what did the person do. And in this case, the person violated the requirements of NRS 453.336. He did stuff that's forbidden by that statute.
But again, this argument becomes somewhat circular because it hasn't knowingly or intentionally possessed element to it. And in this case in particular, I'm not sure that that element is met.
Well, I
again, going back to the policy.
In two ways. First of all, that's really an argument that ignorance of the law is no defense. Mr. Hohenstein, who is a licensed professional in the state of Nevada, does not know the law that applies to his profession, and therefore is not aware, for instance, that he cannot take one of his students to his home and show his student pornography because he didn't read it. There's also testimony in the record that he went through an orientation when he started as a teacher, that he was provided with the information by the school district and was fully aware of the law that applied to teachers who teach in the state of Nevada. His testimony was that he didn't know he couldn't do this. The district, the referee specifically found that testimony not to be credible. And this court has stated over and over again that it cannot substitute, it cannot weigh the evidence, and it cannot substitute issues of credibility for that of the trier of fact.
Could I ask you a question, just to clean this up a little, because there's so many moving parts to these arguments. If the claimant had had a proper license and all the facts were the same except no criminal charge, he had a license and he had marijuana and his ex-wife called down the police upon his head and they investigated and found the marijuana, and that were reported to the school district, would that be immorality under the statute?
If it violated the provisions of NRS 612.336. And in this case, it did, because he had more than an ounce of marijuana. He did not have the proper certification in Nevada to have that substance.
So it's the quantity plus the lack of certification that made the act of possession in his home immoral.
Immoral as a matter of law under the statute.
And no consideration given to the fact that a doctor told him that this would help his condition.
Unless the school district is supposed to decide that it can determine that the law doesn't apply to itself and therefore ignore the law and say, even though he violated the strict provisions of the law, we're not going to enforce it because we think that he simply didn't understand what he was doing. That's an equitable determination that I think that the school district properly declined to engage in. They looked at the law as it applied, and they applied it. And I do not believe that this court should find that this careful examination of the facts of this case, both by the school district and the Unemployment Security Division, should be thrown out simply because of equitable consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, with regards to...
Get this out of your way so you don't knock it over.
It's a good idea. Thank you. There's some very interesting, this is a very interesting case, and there's some very interesting points that came out. One of the things I want to address is Mr. Susich and the school district's position has been that there simply can't be a written policy for everything, that teachers are supposed to have a crystal ball, I guess, and just sort of know everything that they're not supposed to do or are supposed to do. It all goes back to the good faith belief of my client that he was not willfully violating a known school district policy with regard to his possession of marijuana outside of school grounds, in his house, off duty. There is not a policy that specifically prohibits what he did.
But counsel is pointing to a statute that implicates an immorality aspect of this that is a different consideration.
I don't know that it is a different consideration. The misconduct analysis requires an element of wrongfulness. I understand that the immorality aspect with regard to his termination or their ability to revoke his teacher's license, which they never did, the record reflects. But that is, in order to find that there was misconduct, the law is clear. The law that's been cited by both parties is clear that that element of wrongfulness has to be there. It has to be there. It has to be a knowing violation of a reasonable expectation of your employer or its school district policy. And my client, Mr. Susage, admits that my client was confused. That clearly negates any element of wrongfulness. And the record it's all over the record that he did not willfully violate a known policy. And to take that a step further, It's the employer's burden. It was their burden to establish his willful violation of the school district policies, and they simply couldn't do it. There wasn't substantial evidence of a clear policy of Mr. Hohenstein's intent or his willful misconduct. It's undisputed that he had marijuana. The amount that he had is disputed. He wasn't sure, and the testimony that he gave to the appeals referee was that he wasn't sure because some of the plants were in various levels of growth, and some were seedlings, and that is not, that he simply didn't know legally how much he had.
Yet Mr. Susich answers fairly enough that in another proceeding, your client told the court that indeed he had more than an ounce, thereby entering a plea that would later lead to his participation in the drug program. He was never convicted. I understand that.
Right.
But there was an admission in that context of more than an ounce. Was that admission part of the record before the referee?
Yes, I believe that it was. But again, that admission was for the purposes of entering a guilty plea.
How do we deal with that? I mean, do we disregard it entirely? It's a little confusing how to deal with that.
I don't disagree that.
And understanding that that's a necessary part of the plea agreement for the judge to accept it in order to be placed in this diversion program. So that puts him in a very difficult position. But how do we deal with that?
Well, again, it goes back to the misconduct analysis. It's the wrongful intent. It's the wrongful violation of a known school district policy. He believed that his off-duty conduct that he believed was justified, and he was, by the way, in the process of getting his license. He did not have one, but he had applied. He was in the process, and the record reflects that. It was the off-duty, the fact that it was off-duty, the fact that he didn't intentionally violate a known policy. He testified he didn't know what the policy was. And that's the heart. Okay, thank you. I was just about finished anyway. We would respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's finding denying the petition for judicial review and remand with instructions to reinstate Mr. Hohenstein's employment benefits that were initially awarded to him back in June of 2009. Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for the briefs and oral arguments. They were excellent. This matter will be submitted and will be at ease until the next group of lawyers can come.